5. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, Rabble.ca editor Nick Seabrook sits down with publisher Sarah Sahagian to talk about what's coming up this fall at Rabble. They discuss exciting new fellowship opportunities, upcoming events, and the site's editorial priorities for the season, including a focus on the upcoming NDP leadership race. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
All right. I'm speaking today with Rabble's publisher, Sarah Sahagian. Sarah, how are you doing?
Hi, it's great to be here, Nick. Yeah, let's get to it. Let's start this conversation. I know you've got a lot of exciting agenda items.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk and our listeners are going to get to learn a little bit about what's going on here at Rabble this summer. We're going to talk about some of the interesting things that we're going to be presenting over the next few months, as well as some of the big issues that are in the news right now, whether it be the NDP leadership race, the recent announcement of recognition of the Palestinian state, tariff issues, Per Polyev's impending by-election to try and get back into the House of Commons. All those things will be covered in this conversation. So to get started, Sarah, what are some of the great things that are happening at Rabble this summer right now?
So we're wrapping up our summer fundraiser. Thank you to everyone who generously donated. You are empowering us to tell the stories that matter. So we are going to be able, thanks to some generous donations, to have closer coverage of things like the NDP leadership race that is starting to take shape. We also have an upcoming fellowship. So watch this space. If you or someone you know may be interested in applying for that fellowship, it's a great learning opportunity. But Nick, one thing I really wanted to talk to you that's been in the news and we've done some coverage on is what I just mentioned, the NDP leadership race. So why don't you talk to me a little bit about Rabble's commitment to following that closely and why that's so important to us as a publication?
Yeah, well, Rabble has a strong history of covering progressive politics. The NDP has been at the forefront of the fight for progressive issues in Canada for many, many decades. And obviously, this is something that we're very interested in sharing with our readers as to what the future of the progressive movement will look like. We recently wrote a story on the start of the leadership race. The leadership race officially starts in just a few weeks on September 2nd. And we already have a couple of people in the race, one of them being Eve Engler. Engler, he's written before on Rabble. Those familiar with the activist space will definitely know Eve by reputation. And he was endorsed by the NDP Socialist Caucus to run in this race. He seems to be very much positioning himself in opposition to Heather McPherson, who is the NDP MP for Strathcona Edmonton. Not officially in the race yet, but Eve seems to believe, and others seem to believe, that she's priming herself for entry into this race. And Sarah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on what the race looks like so far and why you think it's important for us to be covering this.
So I definitely think it's important for Rabble as a progressive publication to cover this race. I'm seeing not very much coverage in the media so far, and that might change as we get closer to the actual vote on leadership, which is several months off. But even though the NDP lost official party status, it's still important for us as a progressive publication to platform progressive parties like the NDP and the Green Party, who both lost ground in the last election. So just because they have less support in Parliament, I don't want people to lose track of their new ideas and also the debates that are going to shape the future of these parties. So that's really important to us. And so that we're going to watch this space closely, and we're hoping that we can send somebody to the convention when it happens. So one thing I wanted to ask you, Nick, about is, so Heather McPherson has been described by some people as kind of the establishment candidate for the NDP. Why do you think that's the case, that people see her that way? I'm just curious about that.
I think that's a greater symptom of how the party's brand itself has changed as a whole. I think, especially if you look at the last race, obviously there were a lot of external pressures on the last election that helped shape that race, that helped push people to the two major parties. And it became a very one or the other kind of a choice because of you were either associated with the Donald Trump tariffs as the conservatives were, or you were associated as being in opposition to Donald Trump as the liberals became. And I think the NDP, it kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit. And in terms of issues that were traditionally owned, it didn't really pursue those issues as heavily in this last federal election campaign, most notably climate change and pipelines. You even had former leader Jagmeet Singh advocating for the creation of more pipelines. So I think because of that, some voters felt that the NDP brand had been watered down and become more mainstream, more establishment. And I think for some, that paint was kind of brushed across all of the MPs who won re-election, including Heather McPherson. I will say that, you know, some of the things that McPherson's notable for, probably the biggest thing that she was notable for in the last session of Parliament, was putting forward a motion calling for an end to all arms being sold by Canada to Israel. And that motion did pass. However, it was non-binding, and the Liberal government has found many ways around that, many loopholes, and has continued in one capacity or another to continue to send weapons to Israel.
And I think that is a good segue into our next topic, which is recognition of the Palestinian state. So listeners, you can go back into our archives for an interview that Nick did last week that talks about this in depth. But Nick, I would just like to ask you about any developments on the story. So since this announcement happened, have we seen anything change in Canada in terms of policy?
I would say not drastically. And you will hear this in that episode I did last week with Jason Toney of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, where he kind of suggested that the decision by Mark Carney to recognize a Palestinian state was more done for political gain for the Liberals rather than any sort of strong feelings about what's happening in Palestine. And you'll have seen in Mark Carney's announcement that there are far more things that he is demanding from Palestinians in exchange for recognition of the Palestinian state, rather than anything that he is offering as leader of Canada to help support the creation of the Palestinian state beyond a gesture of recognition.
Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because I remember in the interview that you did last week, there was discussion about whether there should be stronger sanctions against Israel, similar to what has happened with Russia. And obviously, sanctions are a tool that no one ever wants to use because they can really punish the people of a country, but they can definitely have an impact. They can have an effect. And we know that there are many people in Israel right now who are against what's happening in Palestine. And I want to make that clear that this is Netanyahu's politics are very extreme, right? There are many people right now who are protesting in the streets. There are people who are refusing to serve in the war because they believe it is a genocide. And so there's definitely opposition coming to Netanyahu from outside the country, also from within the country. Absolutely. But why do you think we haven't seen stricter sanctions against Israel up until this point? Because as we recently found out, even the ban on selling arms and parts for arms to Israel didn't really work. We're still sending parts for weapons to Israel.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that there are a few different reasons behind that. Some of it is purely for profit. There are a lot of moneyed interests that are making a lot of money off of the sale of arms to Israel and who use that money to lobby the federal government so that they can continue to send arms to Israel. And also there are lobby groups who support what Netanyahu is doing. And we've seen them also mobilized in Canada on different occasions, whether that be, Eve Engler in particular being arrested earlier this year for a speech on social media opposing the genocide in Gaza. His charges were later dropped. More recently, you've seen a paramedic in York Region who was dismissed from her job for similar reasons. And now there's a big campaign to see her reinstated as a paramedic for the York Region. So, you know, I think that you're seeing these issues continue because, as often throughout history, the side with the least amount of money and has the least amount of political influence and therefore is the underdog and needs that grassroots support, which I'm very proud that through the help of our donors, we've been able to cover closely throughout, you know, the past year and a half and beyond, whether it be my interview, as I mentioned last week, with Jason Toney, or other interviews that we've done with, say, Dr. Yipeng Yi, who was part of the Global March to Gaza and briefly participated in the Freedom Flotilla ship, the Handala, which tried to break the famine and the blockade on Gaza earlier this summer. So all of those stories are available on rabble.ca, which is just a little plug.
I think one of the issues with Netanyahu is it's interesting. He's just done so much wrong. His record is so, so troubling. I mean, charges of bribery in addition to this genocide. Another news story that was completely forgotten because it happened right before October 7th in 2023 was that he sold weapons to Azerbaijan, which they did to expel which they used to expel the Armenian community. So he funded an ethnic cleansing of Armenian people right before this conflict began. And so, as somebody with Armenian heritage, this whole situation has been very interesting to me because, I mean, I was talking about this with people for sort of a week, and then for many reasons that story became eclipsed. But this is a person who, in one term in office, has participated literally in two ethnic cleansings. And obviously, there are lots of people who want to try him for war crimes, to try him for crimes against humanity. But I think that one of the things that when we have to consider when it comes to sanctions is that this particular person is incredibly problematic and is clinging to power. And it seems like until he is gone, that there is not going to be a resolution. And this is also a leader who has not done a particularly good job in many Israelis' books of getting the hostages back. There are some people who disagree with that and are in favor of his policies, but many people feel that he has put his own agenda to occupy Gaza above the safety of the hostages who were taken. So it is upsetting to see how this is playing out and how it feels like literally no one is benefiting except specifically at this moment, Netanyahu and those who are in favor of his pretty extreme genocidal take on what should be happening now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that getting back to our first topic just about the NDP leadership race, I hope to see this taking a forefront in the discussions. I know that we're in a political landscape in North America and around the world with so much going on that issues like these can sometimes get lost in the shuffle. But you know, it can also cost progressive candidates to not follow up on these important issues and be taking a stand on these issues, as we saw with Kamala Harris last November and in the presidential election in the U.S. So, you know, yes, definitely, it's something that we're going to continue to follow here. We feel very passionately at Rabble that it's so important to get as much news out as we can. We publish several op-eds on this every single week. We have two brand new ones that just came out this week, analyzing not only Canada's recognition of a Palestinian state, but also what needs to really happen to ensure an end to the genocide in Gaza and for a Palestinian state to be successful.
Absolutely. Well, now we can move on to our next topic, which is tariffs. And that's something that I would say Canadians have been talking about all year. The word of the year in Canada is at this point probably tariff, what that means, what it doesn't mean. So Mark Carney's ongoing negotiating tactics. This is pretty interesting. And I've had lots of kind of, I would say, park debates with my parent friends about this, because that's where I see other adults as a parent. And this is a debate a lot of people are having. Is he negotiating well or not? And I mean, the truth is, it's hard to know. I mean, we elected a man who had no real history as a politician. I mean, obviously, yes, he was a very successful central banker. But I mean, you wouldn't necessarily send a really successful astronaut to do heart surgery. So being a smart person doesn't mean that you're going to be good at everything. And it's hard to tell, is he failing or not? I mean, Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico actually is probably the world leader who's proven herself the most adept at negotiating at Trump and getting what she wants from him. And I actually think she's not really getting her due, as many female politicians do often get overlooked when they are successful. Keir Starmer arguably got a better deal. What do we think? And what's the story here?
I mean, I think that Mark Carney thinks he's playing chess, sitting across from someone who's playing chess, when he's really sitting across from someone who's cheating at Candyland. He repealed earlier this summer the digital sales tax, which was on certain American social media and other digital internet companies who operate in Canada, who gained a lot of money from operating in Canada, but were not paying any tax on that profit. And Donald Trump said, well, if you don't take this tax off, then I'll raise tariffs on you. So Mark Carney took the, repealed the tax, and he raised the tariffs anyway. And then Mark Carney continues to negotiate. Mark Carney recognizes a Palestinian state, and Donald Trump says, well, for that reason, I'm going to raise tariffs on you. And he's then the deadline at the beginning of this month for a deal, 90 deals in 90 days, expired. And Trump raised the tariffs on Canada on non-free trade agreement compliant goods again. And this time it was for fentanyl crossing the border, which Canada's amount of fentanyl that crosses from Canada into the U.S. is a tiny, tiny amount, less than 1% of the total that crosses into the U.S., practically zero. And where most of that fentanyl is coming from, Mexico, Mexico got a 90-day extension on their ability to negotiate a new deal with the U.S. without having to face higher tariffs. So I think the issue is not even the tactics Mark Carney is using in his negotiating. I think the fact that he's trying to continue to negotiate at all and pretend that the Trump administration is a rational partner in these negotiations is the problem. And I think one thing that he is doing that I think is good is looking at other partners around the world and expanding Canadian economic partnerships with those countries like the European Union.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think Canada, just as he has said, and this is to paraphrase Mark Carney multiple times, really has to stop relying on them quite so much. It will be interesting to see what happens going forward. And part of me doesn't want to fault Carney as a bad negotiator. Part of me thinks, I mean, he's an unproven quantity because he hasn't been in politics previously. So maybe he is a bad negotiator and doesn't know it. How would he know? But part of me thinks that this might be connected to the fact that at the end of the day, Trump will always just want Canada to be part of America. So he's never going to negotiate with us in good faith because he just doesn't want us to be a sovereign country, whereas he hasn't expressed the same ambition to just annex all of Mexico. So that might be why he is being more cooperative with Claudia Sheinbaum. However, I don't want to dismiss her talents as a politician. I'm sure she's doing a great job negotiating.
Yeah. And, again, tying this back into the NDP leadership race, because it is becoming such a focus for us here at Rabble, as I say it should be. But I hope that part of the NDP leadership race is talking about supports for workers who are affected by these tariffs. Talk about reorganizing Canada's trade philosophy into a more globally ethical way, avoiding trade with countries that don't have good standards of safety and pay and human rights for their workers, and partnering closely with unions on this issue, I think, is something that we're going to hope to see from the next NDP leader. And I think it will help shape this upcoming race. Now, just with the few more minutes that we have left, I want to jump ahead to Pierre Poilievre. Pierre Poilievre, of course, also living through the fallout of April's federal election. He is facing re-election in a by-election this coming Monday, August 18th, in the riding of Black River Crowfoot. Poilievre is running in the safest, probably the safest, conservative riding in the whole country for re-election, after he surprisingly lost re-election in his longtime riding in Ontario of Carleton Carlton Place, I believe, was the writing. So I was just wondering, what are your thoughts? Do you feel that it's time for the conservatives to move on from Polyev? Do you feel, what do you feel about the arc of Polyev's narrative as a politician, where it is now?
Well, it's a great story about white male privilege, because if he'd been racialized, if he'd been a woman, they would not have given him the second chance and handed him a victory on a silver platter.
And I will just say on that, it is a woman who ultimately suffered the immediate political consequences of Polyev's loss. The conservative campaign manager, Jenny Byrne, announced this week that she would not be managing the next conservative campaign. And she was the target of much of the ire of the conservative base for why Polyev lost that seat. But continue.
No, absolutely. And the truth is, if you have a completely flawed candidate that people just don't find compelling, there's only so much you can do as a campaign manager. So it does bother me. I also just think, strategically, it doesn't make sense for the Conservative Party. I feel like this is just them sabotaging themselves. This is them imploding. I do understand why Carney strategically said, oh, yeah, we'll help get you that by-election as quickly as possible, because if you've beaten someone once, you figure I can probably beat him again. Better the devil you know than picking someone a bit more moderate and a little bit more electoral like Peter McKay. I know Peter McKay's run in the past and not secured the leadership, but it strikes me as kind of an armchair political strategist. I've never actually done it. But someone like that would actually be quite electable. And I think that there are a lot of people in this party, a lot of voters who would like to see return to kind of more moderate conservatives who are really business friendly, but not necessarily as socially conservative. I think that there is an appetite for that. And definitely a lot of swing voters who sometimes vote liberal, I think, would find that compelling. But it seems like this party doesn't want power. What do you think?
Well, I think that the issue is a lot of external pressures. I found it very interesting that Jenny Byrne, in the podcast interview she did earlier this week, where she announced that she wouldn't be running the next campaign, said that Pierre Polyev was very good at reaching anti-COVID vaccination voters who are still disaffected, and he got them out of their mom's basements and to vote conservative. And to me, that doesn't sound like a winning formula for a healthy future of a party, a group of voters that are anger-based, low information, conspiracy theory driven. And I think that this, though, is the ultimate identity crisis that the conservative movement across North America, you could argue across the world, is currently dealing with in the Trump era, is that this is what a lot of the base in these movements have become. Even if some of the mainstream and the elected officials in the party are no longer comfortable with that, they feel that they're being swept along with that current. I think that that's going to continue. And I don't know if a party like that can survive when the main animus for it, which is Donald Trump, is no longer a political factor.
It will be interesting to see how they evolve and when they have that reckoning. It might mean that for a couple of elections, they actually do worse. But I think in the long term, it is how they can actually get that critical mass of support and win an election. And we'll just see if they are able to think that strategically as the party. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, we're at the end of our time, Sarah, at the end of another episode. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about all these fantastic news stories that we've been covering here at Rabble, and hope to discuss some more as we see the news evolve and we get back into the busy period after Labor Day.
Anytime.
That was Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian in conversation. Thank you so much for that, Nick and Sarah. Switching gears now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's turn things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with labor news. Flight attendants with Air Canada are poised to strike this weekend. Last Tuesday, the flight attendants, who are represented by the Canadian Union of Public Employees, voted over 99% in favor of striking. The union gave a 72-hour strike notice on Wednesday, August 13th, and Air Canada responded by issuing the workers a 72-hour lockout notice. The issue is pay, as well as ending unpaid work. Flight attendants are only paid for as long as the plane is in the air. The work of boarding and deplaning passengers, prepping food and drinks, and cleaning the plane are all forms of unpaid labor. As well, if a plane is delayed from takeoff, as often happens, flight attendants on that flight can go several hours on the job without being paid. Staying in labor news, remote work remains popular among employees, even as many workplaces shift back towards in-person work. Remote work was, of course, introduced in response to the COVID-19 pandemic to limit the spread of infection. A report by the Angus Reid Institute shows that nearly 60% of all workers surveyed would prefer working every day remotely. Remote work allows for a better work-life balance, while reports show productivity does not suffer. The mandated return to the office particularly will be disruptive for those who have significant responsibilities outside of the workplace, like parents. Allison Vendetti, an HR professional and the founder of Moms at Work, said that the mandate against remote work will create particularly heavy burdens on working mothers and other people who take on caregiving labor in their family. Also this week, reactions are pouring in to Prime Minister Mark Carney's recent announcement that he would recognize the Palestinian state at a September meeting of the UN. And an op-ed on Rabl, Fareed Khan explains that this is a largely empty gesture without concrete action to back it up. Carney's pledge comes without a commitment to end the supply of Canadian weapons to Israel. Khan writes that Carney should also suspend the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement. Israel's attacks on the Palestinians of Gaza continue, as do attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinians living in the West Bank. Without Canada pushing for an end to violence against Palestinians, Khan writes that the recognition of a Palestinian state lacks any real force. And finally, in provincial politics, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith has instituted a new controversial rationing system for the COVID-19 vaccine. Last year, the province administered 750,000 doses of the vaccine, mostly to those at risk of complications and those aged 50 or older. This year, the province has reduced the number of vaccines it's ordering to 485,000. Those who want to receive a vaccine will have to apply for an appointment through the government's website, where the province will randomly select those eligible to receive it. COVID-19 continues to be a seasonal issue and caused 380 deaths in Canada last year. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories and more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.